Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown,
where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
Tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 163 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom.
And Sarah Lytle, along with the rest of the crew. This month, our musical guest is Jan Bell. We'll hear a combination of her pre-recorded music and a couple of tunes that she recorded in our studio. Corey Flick and Bob Blass share a conversation about their Hippies and Cowboys event at the Music Center.
Matthew Jackson returns to the studio with more tales of paranormal adventure. Deb Bowden has a Halloween story and will share the latest edition of Stoveside Surveys from Rick Albertson.
Lynn Letzinger-Miller shares some information about what's going on at the Brown County Art Gallery. And we have essays from Jim Eagleman and Dave Seastrom.
Segment one begins with our Jan Bell interview. We'll hear her original pre-recorded tune called Yorkshire Water. Corey Flick and Bob Blass share the lowdown about the Hippies and Cowboys Festival at the Brown County Music Center on October 25th, featuring 30-plus vendors, live music, and a car van show, and more.
Our guest tonight splits time between Brooklyn and Brown County, founder of the Brooklyn Americana Music Festival, Jan Bell.
Oh, it's great to be here at Brown County Radio Hour. Thanks, Sarah.
And so in Nashville, what are some of the things that you have been currently working on?
Well, besides playing music around this fantastic town, I did jump in on three projects that are all kind of in their baby years, or they're all in their about two years old.
Yeah,
one of them is the Hoosier Original Music Association, and I'm kind of their like folk alliance international advisor, because they're kind of a mini organization of the Folk Alliance Region Midwest, which is the regional Midwest of an international amazing organization called Folk Alliance International.
And we know that as HUMAC.
Yes, Hoosier Original Music Association, called HUMAC. But I first went to the Folk Alliance about 30 years ago, and it falls on my birthday, and I'd just driven through a blizzard. My birthday's in February, and I arrived there, and there was a chap there to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award with his banjo, and he found out it was my birthday, and he played me happy birthday on his banjo in the elevator, and that fellow was Pete Seeger.
Oh, my God!
So I was hooked ever since. So now when I work with HUMAC, I kind of help them, like, figure out how to do the Farmette they just did here in Nashville on June 21st. It was
right.
A one-day conference, a music festival. And then the other one, I'd love to work with, is Amplify Nashville. I'm wearing their T-shirt. If we could have radio vision, there might be a picture. And they also are a really altruistic organization that raise a lot of money for local organizations, specifically like Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. And now they have a free music program for young folks, kids here in Brown County. And they do an annual event at the Brown County Music Center. And also they do a songwriter showdown series at the Playhouse. And they do all kinds of great works all around town. And Hippies and Cowboys is coming up in November, which is their next big shindig.
And you are a stage manager for that.
Both HUMAC and Amplify Nashville are volunteer, just like WFHB, you know, volunteer powered. And everybody really gives a lot, especially towards fostering artist development and local talent of all ages, with events that really, like, I think, do amplify Nashville and do celebrate people as artists. Besides WFHB, my other favourite radio station is WNYC, and they recently, on their morning radio, they had a call-in show about what do you do that's intergenerational? And it was really interesting hearing people call in, because I was like, wow, my life is so intergenerational because I'm a folkie, because I'm into folk music. You know, when people ask me about what's life like here in Brown County versus Brooklyn, I'm like, you know what, it's a really intergenerational community here as well. You know, like I have friends of all ages here. And sometimes in New York City, because I'm a folkie, I do have friends of all ages. But like most cities, little communities, even the music community, can be a little bit insular and a bit the same agey, a bit the same persuasion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, luckily in New York, the diversity is at my doorstep. So I'm so thankful for that. And it's one of the reasons I love that city. And especially like the queer community is my family there. And I would not be sitting here now if it wasn't for the, you know, my Rainbow Coalition in Brooklyn. They saved my life over and over. But I also feel like that dynamic is definitely present here.
I would also like to hear a little bit about where you are from and the next song that you're going to do for us.
Thank you. Well, I'm originally from Yorkshire, England. So my capital city was York. So New York is named after Old York. We're known as like the Viking stronghold, you know, like even the Romans were like, oh, let's turn around, you know. And then when they got past York, you know, we made a deal. So they got past York, you know, and then they got to Scotland and then they were like, forget about it, build a wall, you know. So very interesting kind of reflections on things. But Yorkshire, I kind of say I'm from the Kentucky of England. Where I come from in South Yorkshire used to be very much all coal mines. That was the industry. That's what drew people there from the countryside. You were either a coal miner or you were a farmer, or you lived and worked in Steel City, which is Sheffield, which was my big city. And that's where all the stainless steel knives and forks are made in England.
Labor.
And the steel umbrellas and things like that. And also it was like the home to like the punk rock. There was an old lead mill that became a major punk rock music venue in the 80s, you know, probably the 70s, but I remember it from the 80s. So it's Northern England, you know, a lot of people when I grew up had never been on an aeroplane. They'd not been to London. Everyone's related. You go to the pub and everyone's there with the kids and the dog and, you know, if some little kid is running around, somebody
will
like...
Boy, that sounds a lot about Nashville.
Well, yeah, you know, it's very... It's kind of hillbilly, you know. But, you know, my family were nurses mostly. But before that, you know, my mum and dad and all my sisters are nurses. But before that, my granddad was a coal miner. And he went down the mine at 13 years and 9 months old, which is what you had to be. Somehow they didn't make it 14. And he went down the mine, you know, as a kid, as everybody did where I grew up. When he was young, and he's a Christmas baby, and shortly before his birthday, there was an accident down the mine, and he was the sole survivor. This song, Yorkshire Water, is about during the 80s, they decided to privatise the coal mines because it was no longer profitable as a nationalised industry. And we see kind of a lot of that happening in Kentucky and Virginia right now. And this became a big thing in the 80s, and then they decided to privatise the water. And one thing about Yorkshire, and I think it might be similar with Appalachia, is our water is so pure. The Pennine Mountains are nicknamed the backbone of England. So we get all the rain and it comes down through the streams and it's the softest water and it's the cleanest, pure water.
Gosh.
And we're very proud of it. So this song, Yorkshire Water, is about me feeling like first they're closing all the coal mines down and privatising them and kind of really kind of hoodwinking people like my grandpa into taking early retirement, really kind of robbing them of redundancy.
Profit over people.
Profit over people. And then to add insult to injury, basically poisoning the water, you know, by privatising it.
Little ass kicks pebbles down Tingle Bridge Lane, where granddad's pit boots march to Elsica, Maine. Now grass grows over the old slag heap, where the salt of the earth and our blood runs deep. Yorkshire lasses and Yorkshire rum little bairns when times are bad. Mucky face and ends, I bet they'll have a lack. Playing on swings in daughter told me they sold off our soft Yorkshire water, Yorkshire water, Yorkshire water. Backbone of England, our roses need the rain. Hey up, mate, now then, lad, it's chucking it down again. Shut down the pit, cut off the town. Now nobody ever even has to go down Elsica, Maine, ever again. Winch and chimneys fell like chocolate tops. You can't sell the council house and no bloody jobs. The young'uns took off with the kids and the wife, but old uns like us gave all of our lives. Father after son, after mother, after daughter, told me they sold off our shaft. Yorkshire water, Yorkshire water, Yorkshire water.
So much to promote and to open the world for other musicians, but you are a singer and songwriter in your own right. Could you tell us about where you're going to be playing next and how we can find you?
Thanks so much. My next gig's right here in Brown County. I love playing outdoors here, especially in the fall. It's so magical. I'm playing at the Ferguson House Beer Garden on Friday, October the 10th, and also Saturday, October the 18th. Both of those are in the evening from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. I'll have special guests with me, including FHB DJ Christy Crandall on the mandolin. You can ask for her autograph if you like that night, and other special guests from the community, from
Weed Patch,
from Nashville, Kristen from previously of Weed Patch, hopefully is going to join me on the banjo, one of those, and folks from Bloomington as well. You know, I feel like there's so many great people to play with around here.
And you have a website.
On the Instagram, it's at Jan Bell Music, or everything is Jan Bell Music.
Thank you so much for coming in tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Jan Bell, this is Sarah Lytle with WFHB and the Brown County Hour.
This is Rick Fettig with the Brown County Hour, and I'm here with Corey Flick and Bob Blass. They got a big event coming up, the Hippies and Cowboys.
We sure do. Thank you, Rick, for the intro. So Corey Flick here, everybody in Brown County, October 25th. Keep your calendars open. We have a festival going on where we're going to mix the two best components of the county, hippies and cowboys. It's going to be taking place at the Brown County Music Center. We've worked intimately with Christian Webb to make this event happen. Part of the proceeds of the event go back to Mother's Cupboard and Brown County Music Association. So we have six highlighted bands. We're going to have a shakedown street outside in the parking lot that kicks off at 3 p.m. Zion Crossroads will be opening the event. Who am I forgetting second?
Lowlanders.
The Lowlanders, see? Bob knows these things. And then we're going to have Rich Hardesty Band headlining outside. And that event will go till 6 p.m. And that's right when the doors will open to the venue. And the opener inside the event will be Three Beards Strumming. And then Cody Eichert and the Sidewinders. And headlining the big shebang will be High Rider. And I think everybody knows and loves High Rider. We've got 36 vendors that will be outside in the shakedown. Is that correct, Bob?
Yep. And we got food trucks and all that sort of thing. So it's the initial event. We're hoping to have a great turnout and make it a yearly thing.
Yeah, so far we've had a great response. Our goal is 1,000 people, so we hope that everybody comes out and they're going to enjoy the event. You're going to get
my goal is 2,000.
Yeah, Bob says shoot two. High. Bob says 2,000, so that means we got to get on ticket sales.
Got to get on it. Hold
but we've had a great community support so far, and it's another way that we're trying to build the music scene around here and help the community out at the same time.
Yeah, and I think just to dovetail into that, the event does. Like Corey said, Mother's Cupboard benefits, as well as we are doing some programming to further music in our community. It is very community-focused. Right now, we have six youth. We're calling it Amplify Youth. We've supplied them with musical instruments, guitars, banjos, etc., and lessons. We were doing every week. Now we're going to start doing every 2 weeks. But kids that wouldn't have the opportunity now do. We're real into, you know, again, pushing it from youth all the way up. You know, the event itself helps, you know, Cody Eichert, for example, the first year at Amplify, he was one of our first acts that we want to help promote to the next level. And again, we're just trying to impact music in Brown County.
Yes, this show is presented by Amplify Nashville,
yep,
which that is the umbrella of everything we're doing. And then we have the Brown County Music Association that is the 501(c) that we've created to where we can get the money out to needy organizations, needy kids. And we're growing this. Christian's excited. He's been a big advocate of this all along the way. So next year we're going to have another Amplify Nashville.
Yep.
Hopefully another Hippies and Cowboys if Bob and I survive it.
Yes.
So any questions, guys?
Well,
what do you
how
think?
How did this all come about? Where'd you get the idea?
Honestly, I lived here before, previously, and living out in Colorado for a while, my wife and I moved back, and we wanted to give back. And I think Bob and I had a conversation about 2 years ago on how we could, you know, create and give back at the same time, and no better way than music in this county with our strong musical history with Bill Monroe and Ricky Skaggs and the Little Opry. So it's really taken on a life of its own. We now have the Songwriter Showcase, and Keenan and Mandy Rainwater are heading that up, and pretty much a lot of the venues in town and business owners have been extremely supportive, so that helps us do what we do.
I would say one of the big things we need, and, you know, as far as, you know, wanting to make sure that we're generating the revenue through this event, is we need community participation. We need people out there buying tickets flat out, because, you know, the more that we generate, and again, it's very much about, you know, the altruistic sort of thing where we just want to fund the programs. Again, we are a 501(c)(3) organization, so.
And we need everybody from Need More to Story. Come on out.
Where can we get more information about
this? We've got a Facebook and Instagram under Hippies and Cowboys Festival. That's a great place to start. If you message us there, we get back with you right away.
And tickets are available through Brown County Music Center, through their site. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, we appreciate you guys coming in and trying to help or do our part to spread the word.
We
appreciate that.
Yeah, good luck with everything.
Yeah.
This is Rick Fettig with the Brown County Hour, and I'm here with Corey Flick and Bob Blass, and we're talking about hippies and cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
Now we pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from Our Brown County, a magazine for locals and visitors featuring art, entertainment, and county characters since 1995. Printed 6 times a year and available online. More information at ourbrowncounty.com.
We begin segment 2 with a conversation we had with paranormal investigator Matthew Jackson as he returns with spine-chilling tales of Brown County spookiness. Deb Bowden enthralls us with a blood-curdling yarn. Jim Eagleman has a few words about nature's strategic timing for seeds, fruits, and nuts that match bird migration. And we'll close this segment with the Jan Bell song recorded in our studio, Union Sea.
This is Chuck Wills with the Brown County Hour, and I am talking with our good friend, Matthew Jackson, paranormal investigator. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. Seems like we'd have you quite often this time of year to maybe talk about some spooky stuff.
Yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence.
It's a little by design, but you know what? We're always thrilled to have you on the show.
Always thrilled to be here.
Well, let's talk about your paranormal investigator. That seems to run a pretty wide breadth of topics, not just ghosts and things that go bump in the night. It can also be Sasquatch or portals, or it's a wide range, right?
It's a wide, wide range. It goes way beyond.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about maybe something a little closer to home.
Okay.
I know that you have done some work in Columbus, particularly around a bookstore.
Well, I am friends with the owner of Viewpoint Books in Columbus, Indiana, and she has this, you know, has two bookstores downtown that are both in historic buildings that have pretty unique histories. And both of those buildings, people have reported like unexplainable occurrences. We're talking everything from voices to shadow figures to full body apparitions,
okay,
things getting moved. And recently she got a hold of me because she was rather concerned because there's a new commemorative edition of The Exorcist.
Uh-oh.
That came out. Yes, The
okay.
Exorcist.
Right.
And she had this book on display. And one day at the bookstore, her and one of her employees, they saw this book take a flying leap off of the display case it was on and land in the middle of like the hallway walkway there inside the store.
Okay.
And she's had books fall from this area before, but when they do, they fall straight down into the rest of the display, and they create like an avalanche of like books that go everywhere. This made the high dive jump over all the other books and, you know, and landed someplace that it couldn't have landed on its own.
Okay. So it was manipulated somehow.
Somehow. And she was pretty spooked, given the fact that it was The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course.
So what do you do about this?
Yeah. What do you do? You call the local weirdo.
Yeah.
And so she gets a hold of me all concerned about this. And my first impression was it probably was not that specific book. Maybe it was something in the bookstore, because we've been there before and we know that there are spirits that hang out in the bookstore. And so I was like, maybe one of those just didn't like that particular book being there. And that was its way of telling you.
Okay.
But I said, regardless, I'll be over and I'll bring a priest.
Oh, all right. That's a good bonus.
Yeah.
Bring some extra firepower with you.
You never know.
Yeah, right. So how'd that go?
You know, it was really interesting. I really did bring a priest with me. He knew about my work and he was curious if his presence might make any type of impact on the environment. And so we set up some of the experiments there in the bookstore. And through this process, I asked the question, like, you know, what book got thrown? And as plain as day, the first thing it said was The Exorcist.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, well, I know that you work in a realm called ITC.
Yes.
Which stands for?
Instrumental Transcommunication. The main goal is to really establish like real-time dialogue, like to have more of a conversation in the moment.
Okay. So you're using electronics to have a conversation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you ask it, what was the book? And it replied, The Exorcist.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was very amazing.
Okay. So it didn't like the book, clearly.
Did not like the book.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And it was interesting. It also picked up on the fact that my friend there was a priest, which was also really interesting because I asked him not to wear anything that would identify him as clergy.
Okay.
And it immediately started saying his name and called him father, called him a couple different things. And at one point when he left the room, a voice came through and said, I really don't want to talk to that priest. Which was really kind of funny in the moment. It wasn't like a scary thing, but that happened.
I've had enough of that guy.
Yeah.
Now, I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about the whole breadth of your adventures in the last year. So we're going to do an extended interview for our Halloween special. So I would encourage everybody to check out our podcast on Spotify and on our website. It's going to come out the week before Halloween. And you and I have an hour-long conversation about this bookstore, the Crump Theater, a trip to Europe, and about four different trips to what could only be described as a crazy hotspot in Florida.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of everything. And reports of Sasquatch being on the property. and that has grown into a whole thing that involves everything from the federal government to possibly aliens and portals. So it's a wild story.
Matthew, thanks so much for hanging out with us today. It's always great to have you on the show.
Hey, man, my pleasure. I always love coming and talking to you this time of year.
Welcome, Marlene said. I hope we become good friends. Me too. I have lots of plans for our yard. Gwen smiled. It'd be fun to share ideas. What are you thinking about doing? First, I'm removing that old privacy fence. It's full of patched holes. We all have fences surrounding our yards, back and front. I know everyone likes privacy fences, but I don't. Leave it up. Why? Protection. What are you talking about? If you tear it down, the night creatures might get into your house. That's why owners just patch their holes. What creatures? Dogs? No one knows, but they're huge. The board fences hold them back. Maybe it's the taste of treated wood. But it's an eyesore. If you must, put a new one inside the old. Then tear the old one down, but don't leave any opening, not even for one night. Make the gate just as tall, 6 or 8 feet. These things can't climb or jump that high. Weird. In the 1840s, this land was cleared for farming, but strange creatures slaughtered everyone and destroyed the wooden houses. Later, developers came. They ignored the stories, but the monsters returned. So they built stone and brick houses with odd, high windows and surrounded them with tall fences of treated wood. Sounds like folklore. It's not. A lot of builders died. Go to the library and check newspapers from around 1846 and the late 1990s. I did. What'd you find out? Just what I told you. These ancient things don't like humans here. Have you seen them? No. When my husband and I moved in, I was curious and I set out on the deck at night. And what I heard petrified me. They went crazy trying to break through. Maybe someone was playing a joke? No, no joke. That's why there's so many patch spots in everyone's fences, patched with new treated wood. These things tear at the old but leave the new alone until it weathers. You need to check every day and make repairs. So everyone here's afraid of feral dogs? Don't believe me, then. I didn't. It's a good place to live, but after a while, the night creatures get to you. People don't stay long. We're coming. We're leaving next spring. It has to just be dogs. Gwen, sit outside one night and you'll change your mind. Okay, but tell me this. How come these things don't attack from the front yards? Why just the back and sides? The bright street lamps. They like darkness. They keep all your outside lights on, too. Those shutters on your windows are treated wood. They actually close and lock. Everyone shuts them before dark. No one has windows in the backs of their houses, just steel doors. That's why there's no garages either. I'm sorry, but this is a lot for me to believe. Suit yourself. Gwen didn't tell her husband. Frank would jeer and belittle everyone. It happened twice before. He couldn't keep his mouth shut, so they had to move because they were hated. He abused her, too.
He heard the front door slam and Frank's voice. Hey, Gwen, you'll never believe the malarkey guys at work told me when they found out where we lived. What'd they say? Some crap about supernatural hounds trying to eat people. The fools were dead serious. I hope you didn't sneer and put him down. Couldn't help myself. I nearly doubled over laughing before I called one an ignoramus. It wasn't dark yet when Frank went to bed. He had to be up at 4. Gwen thought about Marlene's words. Tonight, just in case, she shuttered the windows and turned on all the lights. She decided to go to the library in the morning. It was around noon when Gwen found the news articles. This really happened. Frank won't believe even if I make copies. He'll sneer and laugh at me. Gwen was thoughtful the rest of the day. She said nothing when Frank came home laughing about his co-workers' warnings, heard the names he gave them. She saw the same pattern emerging. I've got a mind to tear that dilapidated thing down this Saturday just to spite them. I'll have the last laugh come Monday. Frank, please. Mark my words, Gwen. I intend to prove them all wrong. Don't make this another challenge you have to win. Whatever, let's eat. When Frank went to bed, Gwen shuttered the windows again and turned on the outside lights. Then when it was very dark, she sat outside. She heard the sound of padding feet. Then came sniffing and snorting at the cracks. They smelled her. Thick nails tore into the wood, ripping out chunks. Eyes looked through those holes. They paced the fence line, growling and snarling, trying to climb or jump over, throwing themselves at the barrier. The fence shook. Gwen was terrified. She ran inside. When she calmed down, she planned. Frank verbally abused her all their married life. He alienated everyone, isolating her. She desperately needed to escape. The next morning, she took a crowbar to the fence and pried off one of the larger patches. The wood underneath was splintered and chewed from huge jaws and teeth. A head much larger than any dog had forced its way through. Just looking at the damage shook her, bone deep. I'll leave the lights on and the shutters closed. If he opens them or turns out the lights, it's his fault. She went back inside and packed a bag. Her sister Pam picked her up. It's about time you escaped. I'll have to ask Mom and Dad for help. Pam gripped her sister's hand. Honey, we've all been hoping and praying you'll leave. We'll help you. That's what families do, find ways to take care of problems. You're right, Pam. We do take care of problems. She stared out the passenger window and shuddered.
The fall of the year brings a change to the plant world. It's time to promote more of their own kind. They do this by producing flowers earlier in the year that have matured and produce seeds. Seeds can be in the form of pods or nuts or burrs. The packaging of the seeds is crafted to ensure that the seed gets distributed by wind or water, or their spiny construction to catch a hold of animal fur. All of these mechanisms aid in distribution. Some seeds of fruits, simply by color, we call them foliar flags, stand out against the changing leaves and signal to migrating birds it's worth a stop to feed here. The need to feed and replenish energy expended during long flights, it's a good way to see where and what routes birds use as they head south and where plants grow. And it's been theorized by plant biologists that plants can actually extend their range by being attractive to moving birds who distribute seeds along migration routes. The study of migration isn't just to learn more about bird behavior. It can help us understand the important role of plants, how they survive and how they move. Nutritional studies of fruits have also been studied. The amounts of sugars or fats supplied is useful to birds at different times of the year. In summer, as birds are on the nest and more sedentary, they use short-distance flights to feed. The fruits that mature early and are multi-seeded have high amounts of sugar. Multi-seeded fruits mean that there's more chance to germinate in that ideal habitat birds have already chosen to rear their young. Food is assured to be there. Sugar in these fruits power short flights for birds, and we pick them and eat them ourselves, raspberries, blackberries, and strawberries. In contrast, when long-distance fuel is required, it's the single-seeded fruits, high in lipids, that mature later and are available en route. Dogwood, spicebush, multiflora rosehips, sassafras drupes, pokeberries, to name a few. Single seeds deposited by birds along the way can result in these high-lipid fuels germinating on already established routes over long distances and used, again, in future migrations. The need for fuel at different times of the year has been a major reason for further study. Do bird requirements for fuel actually cause plants to produce their fuel at the time it's needed? Possibly, and this is called a selective pressure, where changing environments can affect change in genetics and can result in plants often responding to the wildlife community that uses them. Our pokeberry plant has grown well over the summer. It's now leaning up against our screened-in porch. A recent rain has collapsed it, and now it's a mass of broken branches and thick stems, but each with their cluster of purple berries still attached. We read this as an example of a fatty fruit that ripens in late summer, just in time for the robins, thrashers, and sometimes waxwings to devour. A professor once told us promising graduates as biologists that if somewhere along the line we failed to take our fair share of botany classes, then we would be at a great disadvantage. Any good biologist is also a good botanist, he said. One summer, Kay filmed two versions of wild hydrangea growing right outside our living room window. She captured on her phone visits by solitary bees to each type, a wild version I transplanted from the woods, and a domestic type that looked very similar. Side by side, the two plants were nearly identical to us, but to the bees, there was definitely a preference to the nectar and maybe even access to the nectar. If we are to increase our native pollinators by growing native plants, then it's clear the nursery version, identical in nearly every way to the wild one, except maybe by the nectar it produced, we really aren't helping things. Going wild is the mantra we hear more and more. And a check to the actual plant and its native source is important. Each fall, I look to the oaks and hickories on our property to see their production or lack of it. Bumper crops of acorns and hickory nuts occur in between years of almost no production. It's not a sure thing. Rodents, woodpeckers, and mast consumers, like mice and chipmunks, can determine this way before the fall actually arrives. Nature isn't always in sync, and we often see large food amounts and few eaters, and vice versa. Nature, it keeps us on our toes, that's for sure. And it's another wonderful quality of trying to predict it, and it's sometimes a puzzle. Jim Eaglin for Nature Ramblings, the Brown County Hour. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name's Jan Bell. I'm going to play you a song called Union Sea. The words are by Woody Guthrie. I wrote the melody after being invited to the Woody Guthrie Archives when they were up in New York City. And this was like the shortest little song of the whole deck. And I encourage you to go and listen to Woody Now, a brand new album out of his recordings that he made when he lived down in Coney Island. When I die on this restless tide, lean me over to the windward side. When my sheet is around me tied, left the old plank, let me slide over past hands of Union brothers. And Union Sea. When I meet that long lost foe, that's where I'll find my own true home. Down where the Union porpoise roam, down where my Union sister's gone, over past hands of Union brothers. And
now we pause for station identification.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on Volunteer Powered Community Radio, WFHB, at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 at Ellettsville,
and online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB comes from the Brown County Inn, located just off the main street of Nashville, Indiana, at 51 State Road 46 East. Brown County Inn is also a restaurant, bar, and gathering place for visitors and locals alike. More information at browncountyinn.com. In our final segment, Lynn Lutzinger Miller talks about a new exhibit and play at the Brown County Art Gallery, celebrating T.C. Steele's House of the Singing Winds art sanctuary. And Dave Seastrom shares a few thoughts about living with dogs. We'll close the show with Jan Bell's live recording of Night Blooming Jazz Man. But first, we begin segment three with a poetry feature. The author of the photo book Brown County Folks, Rick Albertson, shares meditations from his new book, Stoveside Surveys, while seated next to the wood stove in his cabin on Greasy Creek Road. Each episode has a companion photo you can view on our website, and Rick starts each Stoveside Survey with a description of that photo.
Looking at a photo of the cabin's heavily wooded, steep 300-foot gravel driveway, fall leaves just appearing in a blaze of color. It's fall. I can see, I can sense, but I cannot hear the realm outside the windows. The trees stand so silent and still, only an occasional flutter of leaves of changing hues belies their tireless, timeless adherence to their ever-so-stately nature. Smooth bark, scaly bark, tall in majesty or less so in hopefulness, they embrace one another, members each of the community of their forest. A sudden breeze, leaves throughout excitedly a dance, wriggling joy one to another. Oh, wait, a gust! Branches swaying side to side, a welcome quickening of pace in each one's leaves, a proclamation unheard, yet seen ever greater late-season joy aflutter. Joy amidst change. These colorful leaves, content in acceptance, ready to dry up and wither, unafraid to free themselves from nurturing branches, giving themselves in selflessness to wherever winds may blow. Gravity at work in time and certainty, downward settling them upon their forest floor, serious in their disintegrating death to feed the soil of their community's carpeted foundation.
I'm Pam Rader with the Brown County Hour, and I'm here tonight with Lynn Lutzinger Miller, who is president of the Art Gallery Executive Board. What's your real title?
I'm president of the Brown County Art Gallery Foundation, which owns the building and the permanent collections. And then we lease space to the Brown County Art Gallery Artist Association, which is also going to be 100 years old. And then to Indiana Heritage Arts, which does a major art competition each year. One of the biggest in the Midwest for representational style artists.
Okay, you stole a little of my thunder there. We're here to talk about the 100-year anniversary.
That's right. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's going to be 100 years that some artists got together and decided to open a gallery in downtown Nashville. But that was in October of 1926. And so as we approach this 100th year, we were trying to think of ways to sort of tell this amazing story. And we started thinking, we need to start where it really began. And it really wasn't with the gallery. It was with T.C. Steele and his wife, Selma, who, on faith, bought 60 acres between Nashville and Belmont and built a home there that became a significant art sanctuary. And they called it the House of the Singing Winds. And today it is the T.C. Steele State Historic Site, and it's owned by the Indiana State Museum. At the time, Steele was really a rock star in the art world. He had grown up in Indiana. He had studied eventually in Munich and had come back and was a major portrait painter, as most of them were. That's how they sort of supported themselves. When he came back from Munich, along with a few other Hoosier artists, they did something different. A lot of artists would study in Paris or London, and they would come back to New York or Chicago, a big city. But they decided that they wanted to kind of follow in the steps of the French Impressionists, who went out into Giverny in France and in these bucolic areas. And Brown County kind of offered them that. The property that Steele was looking at was one of the highest points in the county, and you could just see forever. Selma Steele, she was considerably younger than Steele, in her late 30s while he was in his 50s. And she had studied at the Pratt in New York, and she studied design and was an educator for art teachers. And that's what she was doing when she came back to Indianapolis. She meets Steele. They strike up a relationship.
So this event that you're kicking off in October is tied to the House of Singing
Winds. It celebrates this journey that this young couple takes. Well, one of them is young. We decided to really explore this idea. It's because of Selma Steele that we have the House of the Singing Winds. She created it, she managed it, and she saved it after he died. But her story isn't often told. So we thought, how do we tell this story? And what if they were still alive and they looked at 100 years back? What would they see at its zenith? Thousands of people coming, artists coming. They end up making an art colony.
Gardeners
right,
coming.
Right, right. So we decided that we need to somehow memorialize this moment in time. And so we were talking with Rita Spalding, one of Indiana's top still life artists. And we were walking through the house, and she's like, wow, there's like a million still lifes in this house. You know, and we're like, well, what can we do with this? And she goes, well, I don't do exteriors. She goes, but I know who does, C.W. Mundy. C.W. Mundy is one of the Indiana's premier living artists. So he agreed to do it. So in October of 2023, they began this journey of painting the house inside and out. She was the first artist allowed in the house to paint since Steele died in 100 years. And they decided to look at this. When was it at its zenith? And that would have been in the 1920s, when it was blossoming. Thousands of people were coming. The artists were beginning to look at forming a colony. So as they painted, they made it as though Steele's in the house. So you might see a teapot and steam coming out of it. And if the fences and gates that are around the garden, they took all those out. And we towed a 1926 car up there. So they put together 41 paintings by Mundy, 38 by Rita. The museum is lending us 12 steels. And so that is going to be the actual exhibition. And then we've created a play, Selma and the Painter, kind of based on her book, House of the Singing Winds. So she gets her word in.
Good.
So this exhibit, you get the play, you get the exhibition. It opens on October 4th and runs through November 16th,
yes.
I think. Right. And you can go to the gallery's website, browncountyartgallery.org, or the Historic Brown County Art Gallery on Facebook, and find out about making reservations for our opening night.
And I also read this gallery is one of the longest running in the country.
That's right.
Right here in Brown County.
That's right.
I love it.
And TripAdvisor picked us number one out of 15 galleries in Indiana.
Good note to end on.
So I'm always happy to come and talk about the gallery.
Okay. I've been speaking with Lynn Letzinger-Miller. We've been talking about the kickoff for the 100-year anniversary at the Brown County Art Gallery. Thank you for coming in. And this has been Pam Rader for the Brown County Hour.
The children have grown and moved on a long time ago. And now we have dogs. Actually, we've always had dogs. In so many ways, dogs make much better children than actual children do. The flaw with the human children is precisely that they are human. And we as a species tend to be complicated, self-centered, and generally uncooperative.
This is not to say that we don't love our actual children, because we do, and there's nothing like a grandbaby to make your heart sing. However, the thing is that as far as day-to-day companionship goes, dogs excel in this regard because they've co-evolved with us to be the ideal companions. They pay attention to us, and this is one of the things that we find so endearing about them. Human children are programmed to grow up, leave home, and start their own families. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's nature's way for our species to continue the next generation. This is something a dog will never do, and we all know that dogs are opportunists who will breed with anyone that presents. Dogs never ask to borrow the car. When my daughter was a teenager, she believed that I secreted $20 bills, and she would hit me up every time she needed a little cash. In my entire lifetime with dogs, never once have they asked me for money. Having said that, both dogs and children are expensive, and because we love them as we do, we'll spend whatever it takes to keep them warm, well-fed, and healthy. There's a quote that I really like that goes something like this. A rich man can buy any breed of dog they choose, but only love will make their tails wag. Speaking of choosing any breed of dog, we are decidedly shelter dog people. There's nothing wrong with selecting a breed of dog that suits your fancy, so long as the breeder is reputable and the dogs are well taken care of. But as a society, we have allowed too many dogs to propagate, and the dogs in the shelters are in desperate need of homes. When we lived on Three Story Hill Road, dogs would show up at our house all the time. We had a communal feed bowl that I made out of a refrigerator drawer that we kept full, and the neighborhood dogs just helped themselves. When we moved to the new house on Possum Trot, a friend gave us a Black Lab Rottweiler mix the first Christmas after the move. We selected a companion for him at the Brown County Animal Shelter, and they ruled the roost for many years. When Bugs was in his final year, and wisdom held that he was too old to become a father, my son brought an American Bulldog home with him when he returned from the Navy. When Casey went into heat shortly after her arrival, Bugs was all over her. He passed away shortly before one female puppy was born, and then we had Rosebug. When Rosebug went into heat, she slipped away with a coon dog named Sooner, and a few weeks later, we had 8 puppies to find homes for. We kept 2, found homes for all the rest, and we decided to have all of the dogs neutered. At our high point, we had 5 dogs. As fun as that was, it was intimidating for the delivery people, and we were going through a lot of dog food. As our cadre of dogs aged out, we were eventually down to 2 dogs. From that time to the present, we have always chosen to obtain our dogs from the animal shelters. When you only have 2 dogs, compatibility is paramount. It won't do for your dogs not to get along. We started a new practice when Wilson needed a dog. He was lonely for a canine companion, and he tried to make me his dog. As much as I love that boy, I don't make a very good dog, and we decided that he should make the choice. Wilson interviewed several dogs at the Brown County Shelter, and eventually he chose Max. When Wilson passed away, we took Max to 4 different shelters to interview potential candidates. Max was picky, and for a while there, it looked like he might not choose anyone. We were beginning to think that a companion for Max was a lost cause, when he and a prospective puppy fell in love with each other and we brought Molly home. Honestly, our place in the woods needs a couple of dogs, and it wouldn't be the same without them, and neither would we. This is Dave Seastrom. See you next time.
My name's Jan Bell, and I'm going to sing you a little song I wrote when I used to busk down in New Orleans, and this is called Night Blooming Jasmine, and which is a nocturnal flower that comes out at night. It was written by Bicycle, like a lot of my songs, and this one in New Orleans. I'll send it out to everyone who may be in a long-distance love affair. wise man. I dream runs burning light around a brown skin girl on a summer night. I'm a shelter, this tiny flame. All my kisses come down in New Orleans rain. All my kisses come down. She's hot on my heels, she's a mighty force. Old lovers, did you let them down? The two of you flaunting it all around town. Oh, forgive, have mercy on love that was found. Darling, cross the miles, I'll be sending a lover's smile. Carries the southern breeze, the night blooming jasmine and May. Oh, the night blooming jasmine. Oh, the night blooming jasmine. Oh, the night. Oh, the night.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 163 of the Brown County Hour. This show was recorded in our studio at the History Center here in downtown Nashville and brought to you the first Sunday of every month and the following Wednesday at 6 p.m. and anytime online. Be sure to look for us on your favorite streaming services.
The Brown County Hour is brought to you by a diverse group of folks who believe, now more than ever, the world is for everyone.
This show was produced by
Chuck Wills,
Pam Rader,
Rick Fettig,
Vera Grubbs,
Lucy Schultz,
Sarah Lytle,
Chad Carruthers,
and Dave Seastrom. We would also like to thank Slats Klug for our theme music. You have been listening to the Brown County Hour,
coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County, home.